tomorrow. Garner Ted Armstrong brings you the plain truth about today's world news and the prophecies of the world tomorrow.
And greeting friends around the world, what are the problems that confront you every single day? Mostly joblessness, striving to make ends meet, personal health, the problems of family, our own immediate day-to-day physical, mental, psychological, emotional, spiritual problems. Most of us don't have the overview of this world in space facing an emergency. Rather, we think of our own day-to-day problems and try to solve those with an endless battling and striving and struggling that never really seems to succeed. We think of the immediate problem areas from place to place in the United States of joblessness 8, 10, 11% and more in some areas. We think of dying cities. We think of smog. We hear of crime. We're in fear of that. Even architecture being literally changed as a result of this crime wave today. We're concerned about health, education, urban transit, busing, school books. These are our worries, joblessness, and of course the economy, among the main worries of people today. But where is someone with the overview? The fact that we on this world, the whole round earth, are having an emergency in space. We kick like little children in a tantrum because of the toys that are threatened today in the oil problem, energy, thinking about the possibility of fuel rationing. We always talk, every time we meet someone, first about the weather and then about the economy. We talk about the high prices of things. We talk about the way somebody took us or about the big ripoff or something that happened recently that cost us more money. No matter how much people warn, no, hold prices down, let's lock arms, let's cooperate, let's unitedly solve the problem of runaway inflation. Instead, it seems inflation rears its ugly head even more as we see artificial methods to fuel the economy, because people are still convinced they can get rich quick, they can make more money, they can get their nest egg for a rainy day put away. And we are more concerned about me, myself, and I, about ourselves individually, our own personal problems, than we are other people. And certainly more concerned about ourselves than we are the world itself. We've always assumed that there's plenty of energy. We've got plenty of oil. We're virtually spoiled in the United States. We think it is owed to us. We've got to have plenty of oil, plenty of gasoline, plenty of the energy sources from fossil fuels. We've always had it. It's been all the way down from 20, 30, 40 cents a gallon and below, and going all the way up now to 70 cents and more, and in some places a dollar a gallon if they think they can get away with it. And we feel betrayed somehow. The idea of cheap energy sources is just part of the American culture and heritage. It is owed to us. We need it, we use it, we must have it, and furthermore, we deserve it. But you know, if you could take a look at the fact of this emergency in space and look at the overview for a moment, maybe somehow, somewhere, sometime, somebody could convince you that far more than the Sunday courthouse steps argument or the second martini for lunch bunch argument over the big oil companies, the big rip-off of the giant oil concerns, the fact that they don't really need all that money for exploration, they don't need offshore rigs, we don't need all the pollution that comes with leakage from offshore oil, we don't really need modern refineries, they don't need the billions for exploration and development of new fields. No, they should just keep producing all that energy and give it to us as cheaply as they always did. So there are millions of Americans who literally believe with all their hearts and minds that there is no such thing as an energy crisis, and they will tell you so. They believe firmly, I don't know why, they can't prove it, but they heard somebody say it. They read it somewhere. Somebody says they read it someplace else. So they're convinced that the big oil companies are all conspiring together. And isn't Rocky tied in with oil? And aren't there a whole bunch of Jewish bankers? And what about the Illuminati? What about these weird, strange, creepy people you hear about over in Europe with strange last names? Haven't they really got their hands on all the money of the world? Aren't we all being ripped off? You know, you hear people that have got maybe $225 a week coming in. They're living head over heels in debt. All their own economic problems are their own. They will always be laborers. There's nothing wrong with that. But it's rather strange to hear people, such people, talk about how the big oil companies are taking advantage of them. You honestly have to turn around and wonder, what is it that maybe people on an absolute, very tiny income, or even a fixed income, what is it they've got that Rockefeller wants? It's rather a mystery. But there are millions of people convinced that it's all a ripoff. And so when they hear economists, when they hear scientists and others talk about limited world resources, when they talk about the measured and the known quantities of fossil fuels available in the world's reserves, they simply ridicule the idea. You tell them that the United States has oil enough in proved fields and even those that we think are available for about 11 years, and people simply scoff and say that cannot be true. We want to put that 11 years off to 110 years, and if we can live that long, we'd like to think that it'd be another 110 years. We don't want to believe that literally our world, the entire community of nations, is just like a little village living beneath a hill, and on the top of that hill are great big tanks, and they're labeled tin and molybdenum and aluminium, as they say in Britain, or copper. They're measured water and fuel, all types of fuel energy sources. They're labeled with natural gas and nickel and iron and potash. And each one of them have measuring levels. You can actually go out there and with a dipstick or a gauge find out exactly how much of such materials you've got left. Let me draw the analogy as I did at Apollo 11. An emergency in space. Here were America's astronauts out there. Something had happened with their energy source. They had an electrical problem. I believe something to do with an antenna or maybe one of the big paddle wheel-like shaped antennas that absorbed even solar energy from the sun that helped to power their batteries. But at any rate, they were about to freeze to death. Their heating system was malfunctioning. And so the mission had to be aborted. They were going to be brought back to Earth. And at the space controls down there in Houston and over at Cape Kennedy sat scientists monitoring various devices where through telemetry they could tell exactly right down to the last drop, so to speak, how much water those men had left, how much oxygen they had left, how much energy they had at their disposal. It was a known quantity because these human beings in a little capsule, and by analogy, just like we human beings in our space capsule on this Earth, had measurable quantities of life support systems they could use. Sooner or later, in that emergency, those life support systems were going to run out. We like to convince ourselves the supplies, the resources, the materials, the energy of this Earth is absolutely inexhaustible. But there is never going to be a time when we run out of iron, of oil, natural gas, of nickel, of copper, of tin, of potash, even of water, or of oxygen, but it's limitless. It goes on forever and ever. Did you see those remarkable photographs from the first men who stood on the moon and showed you that little sliver of an Earth out there that looks so remarkably like our moon, except you were looking at it from the moonscape of tortured, twisted, unbelievably grotesque landscape, or moonscape, better said? It was a strange picture, and for the first time in all of history when these space shots began to occur, we could look at ourselves as we look from outer space. Maybe it should humble us a little bit to realize how small, how fragile the life support systems on this Earth really are. Most of the time when we get up and talk about our local weather, our local problems, the crashes on the freeway, our own economic headaches, those physical aches and pains, we're not aware of the world around us, the world out there, the whole round Earth, the people beneath us, about 8,000 miles upside down from us. It really kind of boggles our minds to think about it, so we simply choose not to. The broad overview escapes most people. We don't think of ourselves as the one little speck of life in the blackness of the awesome universe and wonder whether or not there is any real purpose in the trip, any purpose in the journey. Because here we are in our billions on a journey in a space capsule, befouling, destroying our own capacity to survive, meantime arming ourselves with overkill to the tune of many, many worlds like ours, instead of sharing, controlling, preserving, and caring for Earth's resources, we destroy them. The voracious gobbling of non-renewable fuel sources by today's technologies is an incredible thing when you stop to think about it. But we continue on apace, not really realizing the catastrophes that loom ahead. I wonder why we can't ask the questions, what are we? Why are we here on this Earth? Were we put here, or are we an accident of space? Where are we going? What is the purpose for the trip? What is the destination? What happens when we get there, if we do? Or is life just a humdrum experience of all of the aches and pains, the gripes and the not-quites and the never-have-enough, and all the reasons why somebody else ripped us off, why we got the bad end, the short end of the stick or the wing of the chicken, and we're never really fulfilled, never really happy the way we think we ought to be? You look around the world today at millions of frustrated marriages, at unhappy youths torn between the fear of the war which must not be fought and the peace which cannot be achieved. The not-quites of life, things aren't quite good enough, they don't last quite long enough, they don't smell good enough, taste good enough. The trips you want to take, the relatives you'd like to visit, the things you'd like to do, the hobbies you've toyed with, dreamed about, maybe taken a stab at and never completed. The things you promised yourself you would do, you never got around to doing. There are a lot of songs to sing, a lot of wonderful physical sports to engage in you never get around to. You promise yourself you're going to have a slim, trim body next year, but you don't. The frustrations of life, the never quite achieved things we promised ourselves, you can laugh, but never quite long enough. And when you're through, then there's more sadness. Isn't there something more to this? Shouldn't there be more to life? Shouldn't there be some great fulfillment of purpose in life beyond this momentary, day-to-day living, griping and struggling and worrying, filled with apprehension and fear about a world that is unacceptable and a fate we cannot know, and never really finding the real purpose why we are here on this earth in the first place? Well, I've said for so many years it all revolves around the question as to whether or not there really is a God, or whether that is just wild guesswork by a lot of religious fanatics. Is there really a God, a divine power that put man upon the earth, that created humankind and literally prepared this earth for human habitation, or are we accidents of space? You can resolve those questions. I've done series of programs over the years on the subject of evolution, the theories of evolution and how they fail and totally flop in the face of literal scientific evidence. And now, at long last, they're beginning to admit, even in educational circles, and some of the greatest evolutionary minds in the world are admitting, that some of the most current theories, that of the Big Bang and that of the oscillating universe, the two that are in most vogue right now, are a faith. They are a faith as much as any religion is called a faith. Evolutionists say, when a religionist makes the statement, in the beginning God created, they say that cannot be so because you are beginning with something you call God. And that just simply defies the imagination. It is against all laws of reason and of logic. But evolutionary textbook after textbook says, in the beginning was the hydrogen atom. Or they say, in the beginning was a gigantic explosion. Then they immediately begin to talk about the laws that operated upon that explosion. Now, all particles of matter rushed outward from that explosion, began to follow various laws which made them round instead of cubical or angular or triangular or something. How they all gradually cooled. Why? What regulates that? Why do bodies which are superheated begin to gradually cool if the energy source has deprived them? Well, they don't explain that, but they begin with order after a chaotic explosion. And even explosions are, in that sense, orderly, if you understand the laws that regulate them. And so, instead of really looking into evolution and disproving it and coming to believe in the existence of a divine, all-wise creator being, not just emotionally, not because you say, well, I was born a Catholic, or I was born an Orthodox Jew, or I was born a Protestant, but because you say with your own mind, you set yourself to research and to ask logical questions and demand logical and even scientific answers for them. Evolution can be disproved. Oh, I'm not saying mutation. I'm not talking about adaptation. I'm not talking about the nearly limitless variety that is the capacity of a species or a genesis kind, all the way from humankind with the tiny pygmies of the Aituri forest to a giant Nordic or maybe some of the big seven-footers of our modern American basketball professionals. All of these capacities for color and extremes in height and shape and weight in the human race, as well as among fish, birds, and insects. I'm very well aware of that. Mutation, I'm talking about the fact that kind always begets kind, that there are laws that control life, that life begets life, and life only comes from pre-existing life, which is an absolute law. Yet you know, in spite of the fact that it's in Plain Truth magazine, we've exposed these things. We have shown how science writers get carried away with the ideas like life created in a test tube. You know, there are millions of people who will tell you with absolute confidence, manage to even maybe curl up the corner of their lip and give you a little bit of a sneer, pull themselves up to their full vanity of their intellectual snobbery and tell you, don't you know that life has already been created in a laboratory, that scientists have created life? There are millions of people who believe that, even if it isn't true, because it has never been done. No, they have caused certain compounds under certain electrical, and perhaps chemical stimuli in a controlled laboratory environment to so arrange themselves that they say they are dealing with viruses or with various nuclei which are similar to some of the structure of living cells. They've never created even one living cell. And so far as life, well, do you know the arguments still go on as to whether a virus is a living piece of material or not living? They don't really know, as a matter of practical fact. Well, we've exposed that in the pages of The Plain Truth many, many times. But people still confidently believe what a science fiction writer, I think oftentimes they should be called, instead of just science writers in newspapers, might say about laboratory experiments. People actually think eventually we're going to come to the place where we can, well, as a matter of fact, there are quick frozen bodies that exist right now. Many people have already asked that be done. There's a growing, I think, number of quick frozen bodies where people think that eventually, if they die of cancer or heart disease or something, they ask that their bodies be instantly frozen hard as a brick and with a tag on the big toe shoved into a locker someplace and just preserved, and then maybe years and years later, when science has successfully figured out the process of aging and stopped it, figured out the total control of genetics, figured out how to get rid of cancer and heart disease and multiple sclerosis and muscular dystrophy and all the other terrible diseases like arthritis and Parkinson's disease and the like, then eventually when science, which is the god that most people worship, has figured out all of these things, then they will unfreeze these bodies, thaw them out, and behold, they will be given eternal life by science. People trust in science. They've got faith in science. They don't have any faith in God. People in a hospital after an accident, if a loved one is lying in there all maimed and torn up in an accident, they will be clutching their hands together. They will be pacing up and down. Their foreheads are all wrinkled up with concern. Their faces are ashen gray. They logically, normally, and humanly are in a constant feeling of fear and apprehension, a feeling of deep concern, but they look to the doctor. They say, doctor, can you save my loved one? And finally, if the doctor comes to a place where he says the chances are maybe only 10% or something and he will live, he will say, only God can save him now. Then the relatives say, oh no, that is the worst news you could possibly hear, is that only God can do something now. You may as well write that person off. They begin to immediately think, well, I hope they made a will. Or they begin to think, well, I wonder, what about the funeral arrangements? Or what's going to happen to me if my loved one dies and leaves me behind? If people mention God. But as long as you mention science, whether medical science or modern technology, people still have faith and trust. It's incredible that people never get back to that one basic question. Because to me, it solves all the problems. If people really believe with all their being there is a great, all-wise, divine, powerful, creator God who puts you on the earth for a purpose, who gives you life, who actually gives you and sustains every single breath of your body, every beat of your heart, who, as Jesus said, knows every hair of your head, knows you intimately and personally, even far better than you know yourself. If you think of yourself as a child of this universe, a spark of life out here who has a right to be here, who has a right to walk this earth and a right to discover the purpose for which you trod this earth, why you're here, why you were put upon it. It would seem to me that you would want to look into the handbook that that great creator God gave to all of humankind and find out what he says about your very reason for being and why you were here in the first place. But no, that isn't the way it is. There are tens of uncounted millions of human beings who go to this or that or the other church, who call themselves Christians, who profess to believe in God, who even profess to believe in Jesus Christ, Christians, Protestants, and Catholics alike. But somehow, because they've heard a few sermons, they've heard that you have to do this or that to be saved, or maybe they've heard you don't have to do anything to be saved, and they are confidently sure that they have something that they call salvation. Then all this inquisitiveness is simply, I don't know, maybe it's laid on the shelf, maybe it's forgotten or ignored, maybe it's neglected, but whatever it is, they never get around to really studying, reading, looking into, carefully comparing the handbook that that eternal creator God gave to man about himself. The book that exposes human nature for what it is. The book that explains why Christ came to this earth. That contains the gospel, the message which he brought. That is about one-third prophecy, that even defines and describes the conditions you would find extant on the earth just prior to what God calls the time of the end. That even specifically defines events that are going on in the Middle East, and for that matter, around the world right now. But by the millions, there are people who, even though they may think there is a God, they may even believe in a person called Jesus Christ, they've never bothered to look into the Bible to find out exactly what he was like. Did he have brothers and sisters? Was he a homeowner? Did he have long hair or not? What does the Bible say about that? It plainly says he did not. What kind of a man was he even as a human? What was the message he brought? How long was he in the tomb? What did he say? What did he live as a practice? What would he tell you to do if you were to come to him today and say, "Good Master, what good thing must I do to be saved?" What if you were to ask Jesus Christ of Nazareth that question today? Well, he also says that he is the same. "I change not," says the Eternal. Jesus Christ the same yesterday, today, and forever, it says in the book of Hebrews. So according to the Bible itself, he would say exactly to you what he did say to a young man centuries ago, nearly 2,000 years ago now, who asked him that specific question. And his answer then, that you can read in Matthew 19:17 for yourself if you would like, was, "If you will enter into life, keep the commandments." No, you got millions of people who may have a belief in God and even in Christ, but who are biblically illiterate, who do not know what the Bible plainly says. They've never studied it. They've never even really read all the way through and studied and compared the gospel that Jesus brought. They don't know what God said about the original covenant that he granted to Abraham and the patriarchs of old, where he promised physical inheritance of the literal physical earth. Or of a new covenant where Jesus changed that old covenant and now based it upon spiritual goals and spiritual inheritance of eternal life. They don't seem to know that the words Old Testament mean old will, old covenant, and New Testament, new will. That there was an old will of inheritance of a physical material part of the earth for the duration of your physical lifespan. And there is a new will, which takes literal blood to ratify it, which is a bequeathment to a divine creator being, and from that creator being, rather, to his sons, and that there's a family relationship. And it's like the people wondering if the man who's about to die left a will. And here is the very Son of God who died and left a will, a legacy. That's why it's called the New Testament, or the New Will. And there are terms and conditions to that will, just like any person who bequeaths money to an heir is allowed, because he is the person who labored and sweat and worked all of his life to accumulate those material possessions. He's allowed by law to stipulate that there are certain preconditions to inheriting all that money. People aren't really upset by that. I remember a case years ago, a multimillionaire who used to own some property where Ambassador College is located. He was one of the heaviest stockholders in U.S. Steel. I think that his own son committed suicide. Later on, his wife died. He was very elderly. I believe he had two daughters. He was worth many millions. I don't think he ever even knew how much money he was worth. But as he made out his will with his lawyer, being of sound mind and sound body and in good health and completely in total control of all of his capacities, he made a precondition that he wanted his name to be perpetuated. Now, both of his girls, of course, had taken the names of their husbands. And they had children. I guess he had a grandchild or two. So he stipulated in his will that before they could inherit that money, they had to go down and legally change their names or the name of their children, especially their sons, and put his name in there so that his name could be perpetuated. And in that way, achieve a little bit of immortality, perhaps. I don't think they really balked about that. I don't think when they looked at the millions they could inherit that it was all that big a chore to go down to a lawyer and to ask what other processes by which they could legally have their sons' names changed. And they did it. And they weren't resentful of it because they looked at the fantastic wealth they were about to receive. You know, it would seem to me people could easily see the analogy that Jesus himself draws over and over again in the Bible. It was even called a marriage agreement. As God approached Israel, there are at least two chapters of the Bible that show it by analogy as a marital agreement. And he said to them, "Will you abide by my laws? Will you be faithful to me? Will you live according to the way of life that I portray for you? And then if you will, I'll give you protection. I'll give you good, healthy children. I'll give you longevity of life. I'll give you lack of military conscription. I'll give you good crops, good cattle." Why, he would just give them everything. He said, "You'll be the greatest nation. You'll walk the high places of the earth." They said, "All the things that you have said, we will do." That's an agreement. That's a covenant. It's called the Old Covenant. They entered into an agreement which God calls a marriage agreement, just like a marital contract. And so the arrangement went on for some time. But they kept breaking their part of the bargain. And every now and then they had to be punished for it. Not that they had some gigantic, miraculous zap from God's heavenly armchair, but just because God would withdraw his protection, and the natural course of events that they would bring upon themselves would reap horrible results. They never really learned the lesson. That's why the Bible is filled with the history of some of those mistakes, so we can learn those lessons today. That's what the Apostle Paul said. That we ought to learn the lessons of those who lived before. That's the only reason to ever portray one word of history, is to learn the lesson so as not to make the same mistakes. Well, then you see in the book of Hebrews a new covenant, a new will. And God says there are certain preconditions. You've got to repent. You've got to be baptized. You have to receive God's Spirit, a little bit of His nature, and take on His character and His mind. You have to live according to His way of life. It says you have to live according to God's laws. That's what Jesus said. But by the millions there are people who believe there is a God. I don't know if they believe in the great God that had the power to create the universe or not. Or maybe they just have a kind of a father figure way off back of the earth someplace, maybe the other side of the moon or somewhere, that is kind of helpless, that's kind of retired, kind of gotten old and feeble and gone way off, doesn't do much anymore today. I don't think they believe in the God of the Bible. But if they did, I say they'd look into it. They'd read the Bible. They would study it. They'd find out what it really means and what it says. Well, if you're right, for the Plain Truth magazine, you will receive a magazine of understanding unlike anything you have read before. And while you're at it, why don't you write for this booklet entitled, How to Understand Prophecy? You'll see a picture of a strange painted helicopter and a picture of a scorpion and statements out of the book of Revelation that talk about things that have power to sting or hurt men out of their tails. And what about some of the horrifying weaponry of modern warfare, of hovercraft, of tanks that can swim the bottoms of rivers, or of hovercraft that can swim right over rugged hills, and flamethrowers and the like being used in some of those modern machines of war, and whether or not that really is a fulfillment of biblical prophecy? It's free of charge, no price. You can write to me, Garner Ted Armstrong, Pasadena, California, and request this booklet on prophecy. How to Understand Prophecy. Or you can dial right now to the toll-free number, 800-423-4444. That's everywhere except in California, Alaska, and Hawaii. Otherwise, if you live in one of those states, you would have to call the number, area 213, and the number is 577-5225. That's 213, that's the area. The number is 577-5225. Till next time. This is Garner Ted Armstrong. Oh, yes, and will you please tell us the call letters of your radio station? Please do that. We'd like to know the name of the radio station to which you're listening. Until next time, Garner Ted Armstrong saying goodbye, friends.
You have heard The World Tomorrow with Garner Ted Armstrong, sponsored by the Worldwide Church of God. For literature offered on this program, send your requests along with the call letters of this station to Garner Ted Armstrong, Pasadena, California, 91123. Or you may dial this toll-free number, 800-423-4444.